This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2011 annual conference. The session is by Mark Milleron, Deputy Director of Higher Education for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and is entitled Analytics Today: Getting Smarter About Emerging Technology, Diverse Students, and the Completion Challenge.
What I'm hoping to do over the course of the next 45 minutes or so is just engage a conversation with you and ask for help. And I'm asking for help from the seat I sit in with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation around some big challenges. One of the things that's pretty clear about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that we're not shy. The foundation goes after some really big goals, trying to change the game and give opportunities to people in different kinds of ways. Our core mission is to give people the chance to live a healthy and productive life. How that plays out internationally is in work like trying to cure AIDS, cure malaria, small little things like trying to cure rotavirus, and all the work of global development writ large. But in the United States, the majority of our philanthropic work is dedicated also to that notion of giving people the chance to live healthy and productive lives. But that focus in the U.S. has turned to education, in particular because education has become increasingly the core variable that is the predictor of people having the chance to live those healthy and productive lives. Just going to run some quick statistics by you, some quick facts to kind of set this up. The data point that really hit our co-chairs, Bill and Melinda, between the eyes around especially post-secondary attainment is this notion that in the United States, intergenerational transmission of poverty has never been higher than it is right now, which basically means you've never been more likely to die poor if you were born poor than right now in the United States. That alone should make you take pause. But the single biggest disruptor of that cycle is education. And it used to be K-12 education, but that's not the case anymore. What it is now is a post-secondary credential with labor market value. And I want to make sure I unpack that a bit, because we're talking about certifications, diplomas, degrees, not just bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. It's the family of credentials in post-secondary that open up different pathways of possibility for people who want to go on their own journey. Our problem in this is we have aggressively in American higher education done a really, really good job of opening up access to higher education. We've been actually radically innovative in the United States in particular. We invented land-grant institutions, technical colleges, junior colleges, community colleges. And now we're even reaching back with early college high school. The challenge for us is that we've got lots of doors open. The question now is, one, it's getting more and more expensive for people to go through those doors. But even more challenging, of those who start, less than half finish, or about half finish. The bigger challenge with that is radically disparate based on income, which you can tell on the data here, they're kind of just stunning. Around 68% of students from college-going families earn a degree by 26, compared to just 9% for first-generation folks. And let me just break it down a little bit differently. People in the upper two income quartiles are between 60 and 70% likely to finish a college credential if they start it. People in the lower two income quartiles are somewhere between 9 and 15% likely to finish their credential. And when you unpack those data, there are lots of reasons for that. But what is pretty clear is that the challenge for us is figuring out how we can help people leverage that. Now, people are really worried about this on a global scale because of economic competitiveness, and it's not necessarily that the U.S. has fallen so drastically behind the rest of the world. It's that the rest of the world really has gotten this challenge and has upped their game. So more folks are really investing in the world of education and trying to figure out what they can do. So we're no longer first in post-secondary attainment. We're somewhere between, depending on how you read the data, and this is somewhat controversial, somewhere between about 8th and 13th in post-secondary attainment, but we're nowhere close to first. And the one that really hits you between the eyes is that we're now on track to have the first generation of students who are less educated than the students who came before, the generation before. And for us, what's pretty clear is that education is the pathway to economic prosperity and probably to different life choices. If you believe deeply in critical thinking and problem solving and decision making and the liberal arts school skills, then you understand it's not just about being able to earn more money. It's actually about being able to have control of your own life and be able to make your own choices, which becomes deeply important for people as they're moving forward. If you look even further at the data, which you can even take a further step back, and you realize we've got rising expectations. We've got folks, we have higher enrollments, more completion expected from folks, folks like the Obama administration, our foundation, Lumina Foundation, and others talking about greater completion. And then people like Hewlett and others really pushing this notion of deeper learning outcomes. At the same time, we have constrained resources, limited seat capacity, budget cuts, declining ability for people to pay. How many of you are seeing really steep budget increases in your areas? Yeah. And I'm not sharing these data to bring the room down. What I'm trying to do is actually paint the challenge for us. In fact, this challenge is so stark. If any issue where you can get Al Sharpton and Newt Gingrich to collaborate, I mean, this is serious business, right? People are really trying to figure out how we can get around this challenge. And what's pretty clear is we're going to have to do some work to build out a learning infrastructure in this country that takes the scarce resources we have and ups the game, actually helps to attract, to serve, retain, engage, and help learn at much higher levels the students who are coming our way. And in particular, especially for our foundation, what we really care about is not only that we do that, but we actually pay attention to that pathway to possibility that is education and ensure that it's not just the high-ability, high-income students that are served well. It actually is the family of folks from different diverse backgrounds that can begin to leverage education to get themselves on a different kind of pathway to possibility. We care deeply, deeply, deeply about that. And we're trying to figure out how we can do it. I wrote an article last year that was in the Chronicle of Higher Education called Time to End the Family Feud. We're basically making the argument that it's time for us to get over these arguments about what's better online or on ground, using a technology or not using technology, that it really is a time for us to use every arrow in our quiver to hit our target. And that target is more students succeeding at higher levels with deeper learning. And if we're going to do that, we have to get over some of the challenges we've had in the past. And it's difficult because we've got, you know, people with kind of deep ingrained mindsets around this. I want to do a quick little neuroscience exercise to talk about the challenge we have with this. So I need your hands free. So if you're on your computer or on your device, you need both of your hands free for a second. What you need to do is take your hands and put them up in the air like this. Okay, good. Now I want you to clap them together hard and leave them there. Good. Rub them up and down. Clasp them together. Put them in your lap. Now, look down at your hands. How many of you, by a show of hands, have your right thumbs on top? Your right thumb is on top. Look around, everybody. Look at the data. Okay, hands back down. How many of you have your left thumbs on top? Raise your hands. Okay, look around. Hands back down. When the neuroscientists were studying this, they're studying something called autonomic functioning. It's kind of when your brain goes on autopilot. You know autopilot moments well. You arrive at work after a 30-minute drive. You don't remember a thing about the drive you just took, right? You get out of the shower, you're naked, you still have no idea if you washed your hair or not, right? Because your brain goes on autopilot. Your brain likes to get things wired. It likes to get things into these kind of coarse synaptic patterns. You have core autonomic functions you have no control over, like if you sneeze, you'll close your eyes. And there are others that are deeply rote. This is one of those. Now, when the researchers are studying this, they're always looking for correlates, things that these functions are related to or these structures are related to. And when they did this hand one, what do you think they thought it was correlated to? Yeah, hand dominance, whether you were right-handed or left-handed. But you just saw the data. Is it related to that? No. In fact, it's almost exactly 50-50, which kind of freaked them out. So, you know, they're grad students. They have time on their hands. They go after this. And what do you think their next big theory was? Right brain, left brain. And they really went after right brain, left brain, because they were sure this was the big breakthrough on that. And there's a little correlation, but not enough for them to really make the case. So now they're even more frustrated. So they start doing cluster analytics, and they start putting profiles together of right thumbers and left thumbers and doing Myers-Briggs and all this stuff. There's a whole set of stuff around this, and you know how the grad students get about it. By the way, they have a great name for the right thumbers. So for those of you who are right thumbers, they have named your cluster. They call you the sexy people. Okay? I see a lot of head shaking. And yeah. Now, you can't change your thumbs now, folks. So stop that. The left thumbers, they have a great name for you as well. They call you the sneaky people. You're the sneaky ones. And my guess is in a room like this, it's about 1 to 100, and this is pretty stable. About 1 to 100 people put neither their right nor their left hand on top. They put their thumbs side by side. How many did we get? Raise your hand if you're a side-by-sider. We got 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, so the data are about right, 5. And by the way, the researchers say these are the people to watch, right? Okay, these are the ones who are sneaky about being sexy, right? They want you in there. Now, let's go to the meat of the exercise. Go ahead and put your hands right back up where you had them. Clap them together, okay? Clasp them together, okay? And then put them up in front of your face. And now open them up and butterfly them out. Good. Now put them back together the other way with the other set of fingers interlaced and the other thumb on top. Squeeze it and put it in your lap. How does it feel? Awkward, straight. Somebody said sexy, I heard. Okay. I want you to get this feeling for a second because this is the visceral challenge we're dealing with. We are talking about, yeah, we have challenges with Luddites and we have challenges with hyperbolists. Our bigger challenge is with people who've put in 10, 20, 30, 40 years into this thing called education, and they have it wired. They know how it's supposed to work. They know how it's supposed to feel. And you as leaders in technology are dealing with this every day, aren't you? People who just know this isn't right. It doesn't feel right to them. And I think we have to have a sense of empathy about it. And what we really need your help on, and this is my call for help, on the foundation side, is we need your help in catalyzing some conversations. Because we don't think, we're going to be able to ever get to the goals we're talking about. And we're talking about goals in the college-ready side, about getting 80% of our students out of our high schools college-ready, and about, in the post-secondary space, a very simple goal, that most low-income students who start finish. Which is really just kind of a 50% plus one goal. It actually sounds kind of simple, radically hard. And the only way we're going to get to this is if we're able to, again, use all the arrows in our quiver, pull old technologies together with new technologies, on-ground strategies with online strategies, and really figure out how we're going to do it. Now, I'm just going to lay out what I consider 7 of the most catalytic conversations, frame some of them, and then talk about how we can engage that, and especially, again, encourage you as technology leaders to take this on. And as I go through these, what I want to make sure you think about is, in some ways, the sequencing of it, because I want to launch into the first one right away because of our time. The notion of analytics is one that has been an interesting side conversation for a long time. And people have been talking about data more and more, and it gets into the conversations around accountability and for accreditation, and we're constantly doing our IR to find out how we're doing. And let me just make an observation that many of you probably share, that a lot of our data collection and reporting in higher education, a lot of it kind of boils down to narcissistic voyeurism, right? Where we're looking at what's happening to the learners in our environment to tell us how good we are so the accreditors continue to give us resources or so the funders give us resources. Anybody feel that pain? That can't be the goal of our data use. Our data use has to begin to change. We've got to up that game. And I'm a big fan of the article Penetrating the Fog that just came out in the EDUCAUSE Review, this whole notion of beginning to think about data in a different way. And if you want to read about this in the larger corporate sector, big fan of Tom Davenport's work. His most recent book, Analytics at Work, talks about Amazon, Yahoo, Google, all the folks who are leveraging analytics because small moves mean huge returns on investments for them. And if you really want to go to school on this, unfortunately, you have to look at industries like gambling, who are unbelievable, and the gaming industry is unbelievable in using. As I'm going to talk about video games, talk about gambling. They're really good at using analytics because small moves have huge return on investments. And I want to use the term carefully because a lot of people conflate data collection and reporting with kind of more advanced analytics. And I'm going to use the term analytics as a catch-all because I actually think you need to do great data collection, cleaning, storage, staging to be able to do the reporting before you ever get to the analytics. And anybody who knows the analytics understands that. Great analytics begin with ETL, right, and the collection side. So there's a whole process you have to go through. So I'm talking about ratcheting it up. But at essence, what I'm talking about is changing the questions we ask with analytics. It's not about can we get great dashboards for our presidents and our trustees and for our accreditors and for our reporting agencies. Yes, that's important. We want to get them those data. We are not going to transform education and get the outcomes we're talking about until we bring data to learning moments. We got to bring it all the way down to the learning moment. We got to get data in the hands of students, in the hands of faculty members, advisors, so that they can use data to make different kinds of choices. While doing a student focus group, I had a really interesting moment where a student asked this question. Basically said, can you use information about me? And my basic response to that is, yeah, we use information about you all the time. See if this sounds familiar. We're going to put together a committee to study student retention and dropouts. And what we're going to do is pull that committee together, and we're going to start collecting data to find out what our retention rates are and dropout issues are. We pull that data together. We have our first meeting. Everybody argues about the quality of the data. You have to go back out and collect some more data. You pull that together, and now, again, you feel okay about that. You bring some faculty in. Faculty are mad. They weren't included from the beginning, so you have to start over. You then start over, go collect some more information, bring that back together, decide there really is a problem, bring it up to the administration. Senior administration looks at this and gets really concerned about it and wants some comparative data. So now you have to go get data from other places to pull the comparative data together to figure out how you rank and get other places. And then once you've gotten those permissions and pulled that together, you finally get that in front of the president or the chancellor. They look at it. They're really concerned about the politics of this. And so now they figure they have to inform the board. You get on the board calendar. You present to the board the first time. The board doesn't really understand what this is all about at all. So you spend a few months educating the board and helping them understand it. They finally get behind it and say, well, go with God, figure something out, do something around that kind of issue. So you decide to hire somebody to lead that initiative. It takes you 6 months to bring that person on board through a national search. You finally hire that person. They want to install software. You buy the software. After an RFP process, install the software with the consultants, and now you're beginning to do something about the retention problem you identified. What has happened to the students about whom you collected the data? Their kids have enrolled in your institution. Here's the question, is can you use information about me to help me? Right? And this is because this is what they're living with. They're living with Amazon and Yahoo and Netflix and Facebook, and you know this, using immediately data about them to help them make a different kind of choice. You do this every single day, right, when you're collecting all those kind of resources. And I'm just amazed the expectations our kids now have. My 11-year-old was complaining this weekend because of Netflix. He had watched the beginning of a show on Netflix on the computer, and then later in the day watched the same show on the iPad, and then while in the car was watching the rest of it on the iPhone. Same show. And he was just pinging it, you know, with the different devices out of the cloud, and he was upset because it kept messing up where he was in the movie. You think about that, and I think about that myself. When I'm reading a book now off of my Kindle, I know when I get the iPad, I can have a Kindle app, I can go to the exact same book and have the page marker. And, you know, you think about the variations, ways we're getting to it, and then you start getting people giving you recommendations about what you can do next and where you can go. We're just getting that kind of information. For us, the challenge is figuring out how we can begin to get to a place where we have velocity of data. And the velocity is how fast we can use that data to help that individual student. And we begin to do things like, this is just some big markers. One, can we get information to that student based on their data? Like, oh, you're about to transfer? Did you happen to know that students who transfer from a community college to a university before they get their associate's degree are 30% likely to finish their bachelor's degree? So you might want to think about whether or not you transfer now or you wait till you get your associate's after one more semester. Do you think that's a useful piece of info to get to the student? Because many of them are self-advising, right? And they're beginning to make choices without the information in front of them. And if you can have an analytics engine that says, oh, by the way, this person's about to make a choice, get them the right kind of information. And oh, by the way, let's run the data to find out which information is the most persuasive. Think about support systems. Using the analytics to be able to say, these students are the most at risk. Here are the resources for them. The big project we're funding with WICHE right now is actually using a federated data set from large institutions to start looking for those early triggers to figure out how you figure out which students are the most at risk, and you can target scarce resources to them. It'd be pretty nice to be able to say, of the 500 incoming students, these 470 are actually pretty good. Here are the light resources for them. These 25 need some more other kinds of resources. Here's where you should target your advisors, and these 5 need intervention right now. That'd be kind of nice, right? And that's been a holy grail people have talked about for a long time in the SEM world, but we've got to get to a place where we can figure out how we target support, especially as our resources get scarcer. And then the whole learning side, you know, and many of you saw the presentation earlier today by John Campbell and the work of Signals, and this whole notion of getting data right in front of the student, where you say, students like you who did what you're doing have failed miserably. Okay? And just by getting that data in front of the student, it wakes them up. Or students like you who did what you're doing have done well. If you haven't read the research on growth mindsets and fixed mindsets and understand what tenacity is all about, academic tenacity radically matters. And part of tenacity is being able to make adjustments to your behavior. It's called self-regulatory behavior. If we can get them the data, they can begin to self-regulate in stronger ways, and we can actually get them to the right kind of resources. And the outcomes are pretty clear on this. We're seeing anywhere from 15 to 20% four-year graduation rate improvements for this, where people are using this kind of self-regulation behavior. But soon, what we should be hoping for are things like students like you who've had this struggle in chemistry have found these learning objects to be useful. Wouldn't that be great? Okay, and the idea is, again, our true north should not be scorecards for our trustees. Our true north should be getting the data right in front of the students, support, information, and learning that is targeted, that is triggered, and that is tailored to that individual student. If we anchor this, and again, this is where we have conversations about the value of this. Yes, it's technically hard to do this. You have to do all the messy stuff about integrating your ERP, LMS, and operational systems. You have to do data warehousing and ETL processes. You got to figure out your reporting engines. And then you got to get some people who know stats who are able to come together and be a part of a larger stats community to actually figure out the algorithms that will do this work. But it is absolutely worth it. And let me tell you why. If you can get this analytics initiative rolling at your institutions, you make the argument. The goal here is for us to become scientists about learning, to get very clear about how we can improve learning in very strategic ways. And if you anchor that conversation with data and analytics, you then can move into things like, let's talk about blended learning. Because everybody wants to talk about blended learning, but we end up in these sloppy conversations about blended learning where we say, well, yeah, we can do half the learning online, half the learning face-to-face, and we get twice the outcomes. That is not the answer. What you find from folks like, you know, Carnegie Mellon, who've actually done the work on blended learning, is that you, with different kinds of students, it's really important that you tune the blend, that you know what do you do online and what do you do face-to-face. And what we find, for example, is low-income students and students from at-risk backgrounds really need some face-to-face components, and there are times when it makes sense for you to be face-to-face with them. What you see in simple models, like the flip model that is kind of the buzz right now with Sal Khan, and if you haven't seen the Sal Khan stuff, it's worth looking at. Check out Sal Khan's TED Talk on this. This whole notion of the flip model in math, where you tell the student, go ahead and watch the lecture online, and I'm going to give you mini lectures for every concept in math, and that's your homework, is to watch the lecture with worked examples online as many times as you can, and then come to class, and your class time will be homework. Where you traditionally did in terms of worked examples, we're going to do that together. You'll do the homework together, and your home time will be spent watching the lecture. And that flip model, what you find out is a student say, yeah, when I really needed the teacher was 11:30 at night when I was stuck, right? I didn't really need the spray and pray lecture. That was wonderful. But record yourself, right, and let me watch that, and I'll watch it 20 times. And when I'm lost on, I'll come in, and we can ask the big questions before you start the work, but we'll work together on it. Does that make sense? But then we can start going to school and figuring out what are the subjects where that makes sense, what are the topics where that makes sense, and we can begin to tune the blending of our resources to figure out what's the right stuff to put online, the best stuff to put online, and I love this line, and I'm borrowing it from Carnegie Mellon, how do we make the human moments precious? The time we have with the students, how do we make it precious so we have the highest possible learning outcomes? And we figure out, again, what we can leverage in the online environment, what we can do in the face-to-face environment, and tune the blend to make it really effective. What's fascinating to me is I love putting up WebMD because we are driving doctors crazy because we have tuned our medical environments, right? We go to WebMD and fully self-diagnose and come in with printouts to our doctor's visits. We already know what's wrong with us. We just want them to write the script. And we want to know if they know something because we've already read everything about it. I have friends who are docs who tell me this happens to them every day. They're talking with a patient in a patient room. They leave the room to go do something, and they know they've told the patient something the patient didn't know. And by the time they come back, the patient has already been looking it up on the smartphone, right? Because they're immediately blending this kind of idea. The idea for us is figuring out how we can leverage analytics to begin to ask the hard questions around the blend. Good examples to look at, again, the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie. You have to look at the, check out the Sal Khan example, and even look at what the folks at Florida Virtual School have done when they've really tried to figure out how do you do some things well online, some things on ground, how do you leverage the phone, how do you leverage Skype. We have all new tools now, face-to-face tool, phone tools, and others. But if we're going to go to school on this and figure out what is the best use of the technology so we have the highest impact on learning, we need the underlying analytics to be able to ask and answer that question. Does that make sense? Okay. If you can catalyze that conversation, then you can really start getting into the fun stuff about high-impact mobility, because now we have all these devices in different form factors, right? You have all the e-readers coming out. You've got all the digital textbooks that are coming out, digital curriculum. You have people trying to make sense of this digital curriculum and figure out which form factor it makes sense to connect the student to. And the challenge for us is the students are now interacting with so many different kind of form factors, it's kind of dizzying. And as a friend of mine says, if the Kindle and the iPad could have a baby, it'd be the perfect thing for education, right? And going all the way down to the smartphones. And the problem for us is the reliance now on these devices. Do me a favor. Take your devices out. Everybody here probably has some kind of cell phone. Probably half of you already have them out. What I want you to do with your iPhone, Windows phone, whatever you might have, I want you to look left and right, find somebody relatively trustworthy. I want you to trade your device with their device. So go ahead and trade them out. Okay, now I want to make three observations. One, there's a whole bunch of people in this room that are feeling really good right now because you just traded up. This is a great exercise. You like what's going on here. Second, I'm a student of human behavior. My degrees are in human communication science, so I love watching people in these kind of environments. And generally, there's two big buckets of responses in this exercise. There's one group of people, when they hand their device over, that feel the real need to give you a mini orientation session to their device, right? Look, it does that. They're really excited about it. There's another group of people, and for whatever reason this is, they either lock or turn off their device before they hand it to you, right? And you probably saw all of that in there. The third observation I'll make is that the longer I let this exercise go, the more the anxiety in the room goes up because somebody is touching your device. I've done this before where I actually forgot to tell them to give it back. And I can't even tell you how tense the room gets because people are now detached from their digital tether. Right? So go ahead and hand them back real quick because I want that stress out of here before we go on. Everybody breathe. You're okay. You got it back. But why I want to bring this up is, and you get this, you are the converted in many senses. Our students are going to be accessing and are accessing all kinds of devices. And for us, part of our challenge is figuring out how to not make them go back in time, but to actually leverage these new devices for learning. Our problem is we get slapped in the face with people making the argument that they have no value. And you know what? Some of them might not have any value. But we don't have any data to show one way or the other. We have to be able to have the underlying analytics to say, how do you blend? And then how do you use which device at which time to make the biggest possible impact? And then as you have that conversation, then you can start ratcheting it up to say, let's think about the resources that are being used on those devices. So if you go from blending to the device, you begin to think about the learning network that these devices are accessing. Why I want to talk about learning networks is I want us to stop talking about social networks. Learning is social, so it's somewhat synonymous. Our learning networks are social networks. They are connected. How many of you are on Facebook? Okay, look around the room. Of course, everybody is. LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, all those things. I'm on all that. Feel free to connect. What I would tell you is that, you know, is when you do student focus groups, the students talk about the horrible existential moment they have when mom friends them on Facebook, right? And they're, because you're suddenly in their world. What we have now, though, is a deeply socially networked world that's not based on age. LinkedIn is not a kid's network. Twitter is not a kid's network. It is much more of just about people are social in some ways. And our students are actively using social networks to get resources. If you haven't done the student focus groups and asked them about ratemyprofessor.com, many of you have, it is stunning how many of them leverage ratemyprofessor.com, especially your better students are leveraging that resource, which I think is fascinating. And they're not necessarily looking for the easiest teacher. They're looking for the best teacher. And what's interesting also about this, by the way, is Rate My Professor has a great feature called Professors Strike Back, where professors can upload a video responding to what's being said about them on the site. And I always tell people, tell your faculty to be careful. Because every video I've seen on that Professor Strike Back, the professor reinforces the very thing being said about them on the site. So you've got to be just a little bit careful about it. But what we should be talking about is how all those things come together into these vibrant learning networks that are beginning to emerge. You're seeing presentation after presentation at this conference about these learning networks. If you've seen the work of the Next Generation Learning Challenges and some of the folks who are now leveraging things like the Mighty Repository or Hippocampus or OER Commons or the Rice Connections Project, you've got all these open content movements that are standing up. You've got Pearson, you've got Cengage, you've got McGraw-Hill, and all these folks that are now trying to develop modular repositories and communities where people can then interact with those learning resources in different ways. OpenClass being launched, actually trying to really create its own platform for these things. This conversation is out of the box, right? People are beginning to start figuring out how to make sense of what some people have called the junk drawer, because we have so many resources out there. The challenge for us is figuring out how we can then take our information about those curricular resources, especially if we can get them anchored to core taxonomies for the different disciplines, link those to assessments and then to the learning strategies, and begin to do the real hard work of figuring out which of these curricular resources have the most impact. Let me tell you what, some of the most progressive community colleges and universities out there are asking some hard questions and saying, let's do some triage. Let's look at the five courses that are wiping out the most students. Let's now look at the curricular resources being used by those five courses. And let's not talk about textbooks or print articles. The curricular resources writ large. In fact, I love the term curricular resource strategy, CRS. A curricular resource strategy says what are the family of curricular resources you use to achieve the learning outcomes for that course that you then assess against. You curate those curricular resources and you figure out, are they the best curricular resources to actually help students understand those concepts, and do they perform well in the assessments after they use those curricular resources? If you do your work right, you can begin to tune that curation with the analytics and say, based on the assessments, the 75% of these topics they got. These 25%, not so much. Let's find some other resources that can be used for those kinds of topics. But then you can start that curation conversation with data, as opposed to just kind of throwing it out there and using competing publisher claims or competing open content platform claims. You really begin to tune your gatekeeper courses, if you will, or your core courses that are causing some real challenges for you. And by the way, students are beginning to do this themselves. If you haven't seen the, I know Anya was here earlier, the EduPunk's Guide to Getting a Credential, the idea here is that students are now trying to find those curricular resources themselves. And in fact, if you can't get it to them, they're going to find it themselves within the learning network. And part of what we need to do is figure out how to tune these personal learning networks with students and help them develop their own personal learning networks. But if we can do the work of the analytics, think about how that leverages into blending with mobile devices and these kinds of curricular resources, then you go up the chain and say, let's get really fun and start thinking about how we create deep simulation environments, gaming environments, and get serious about play for our students and deeply engage them. If you haven't seen Jay McGonigal's TED Talk about the notion of reality is broken and the use of gaming for learning, it is a much must watch. Absolutely fantastic. How many of you have a kid in your life anywhere that plays video games? How much effort will they put in to go from one level of a video game to the next level of a video game? Yeah, it's stunning. And often they're working in teams. Sometimes they're working with millions of people online, or at least 10 or 20 people online at the same time as they go from one level to the next. Anybody who tells me kids can't concentrate has never watched that behavior, right? And what they have to do is they have to demonstrate knowledge, skills, and ability at one level to be able to go to the next level, which sounds a lot like learning, right? And it sounds like how we document learning is competency-based learning, proficiency-based learning, mastery-based learning, whatever trendy term you want to use. It is about the idea of demonstrating you know something or can do something and moving to a next level. And what they have learned, by the way, is that if you reinforce it regularly, and some of them have cues of at least every minute to 11 seconds to a minute, you have to give some kind of reinforcement to keep them on track with this. You can keep them on track with that kind of learning. What we know is, again, this isn't a kids thing. Young adults and senior adults are all leveraging different kind of simulated environments. Fastest growing cohort for the entertainment game software industry, by the way, is the senior citizen community. And the senior citizen community is taking off with gaming. Why? If you had to guess. They have time. They have money. What else? Oh, iPads. It's what I would call low-friction access to the games now, where it's easy for them to use. Low-impact exercise. You now have these activity games where they can play with it. You also have cognitive researchers and doctors prescribing gaming because they're saying, for the neuroscientists are saying, if you want to stimulate your brain, keep neuroplasticity going, stave off Alzheimer's and dementia, you want to be a rookie every year, which, is, by the way, is one of my favorite lines in all of education. Be a rookie every year. Try something that stretches you out of your comfort zone to the place where you're swimming, and you got to figure things out. That is so healthy for your brain. And they're now saying, you know, they're trying to tell people, go sit with your 12-year-old and have them teach you the game, right? Or go find a grandkid in your life and have them teach you a game and swim for a while. It's good for you, right? And then the big one happens to be grandkids, right? If you have it, they will come, right? In terms of the game, right? So there are all these reasons that people are connecting. But in the education space, what's fascinating about this, if you haven't seen the Kinect system, many of you have been on the Wii. If you haven't seen the Kinect system deeply, you got to go see the Kinect system. We don't have time to show you the videos today. But the idea behind the Kinect system, where you can actually even start weaving in commerce and selection processes with quick avatars, it really is like Second Life on steroids, right? Where you can immediately get an avatar and go into a Second Life environment. You realize this is going to be kind of digital classrooms in a whole different way, simulation environments that are easier to create, much more tactile kinds of things. The interesting thing about this is, again, we need the analytics around it so we don't oversell. My biggest concern is we get all hyped around this stuff and we oversell it and we don't get tough-minded about it from the very beginning. But let's talk about just some of these basic tools to be able to do this. How many of you have seen the, I think the Ford Fusion is one of the ones that does it, that the lower right-hand corner, the little vine with the flower on it? What they found with some of the hybrid cars is that some owners were furious because the hybrid car wasn't delivering on the gas mileage it was promised. And they wrote huge complaint letters and they were really upset about it. When they analyzed what the problem was, what they found out is it was how the driver was driving the car. And so they said, well, it's the driver's problem. Well, that never works well with customers. So they said, well, okay, let's put together a cheat sheet. So they put together a little 10-point suggestion strategy to give to the consumers to help them figure out how to drive their car better. Boy, that goes over well. And so they handed that out, and they did the research on it and found out that even if you hand it to them, tell them exactly what they're supposed to do, doesn't really change behavior. So what they did is they created this little visualization engine using data and analytics, and they created this little vine with the flowers. And basically, if you follow the rules and drive it correctly, the vine grows and the flowers bloom. And if you drive it incorrectly, the vine begins to die and the flowers go away. Now, the teenagers try to kill the vine. Everybody else tries to make it go. But what's funny is this solved the problem like that. Because now people are just, it's immediate visual feedback, you know, which is in some ways why the signal system and others works. But the idea of making this a simulated environment where you're actually interacting with learning in kind of deeper ways. That's a simple example. But I think what we've known for a long time, by the way, that simulations, gameplay, and deep contextual learning matters. This is not a technology thing. People have been doing this for thousands of years, getting people active and actually doing the learning. We just have new tools to use it. And if we anchor it in analytics, we can know when this stuff really makes the biggest difference and how to engage students and for which students it is probably the most powerful if we're going to move forward with it. Now, a couple of final ideas around this. Once we do all that work around the science of learning, you then do the bigger work of looking at your full pathway for your students. If you really care about completion of students, you've got to look from first contact to completion. Okay? From the first time you touch that student to the time they end. And really good presidents will say it's not from first contact to completion, it's from entry to endowment, right? You want that student giving back. The idea here is to begin to look at modal student pathways through your institution and to figure things out. Now I'm going to show you a slide. What we've done at the foundation is we've worked with people around this lost momentum framework. And the lost momentum framework says, let's break the journey down into four big stages and look at the biggest lost points where the data say you're losing students and the biggest momentum strategies you're employing that the data say are really working to launch students forward. And then underlying that are your student data system, student engagement, and the leadership that you have against it. You can't read everything on the slide, but you're going to get this slide, so don't worry about it. We've done it, what we found is there are some pretty common loss points at each of these phases based on the institutions we've worked with. And once you identify these hemorrhage points, for example, if you really want to make, if you're a public access institution and you're working with at-risk students, if you want to make the biggest dents on retention and completion rates, if you don't take on developmental education or remedial education, you can forget it. You're never going to make the impact you want to be able to make unless you actually tackle that issue. It is the Bermuda Triangle of higher education. You absolutely have to go after it. But you have to unpack that. You have to analyze, where are you losing the students at each stage, and what are the things you're investing in that are launching the most students and really helping them be the most successful? Why this is important is because we love initiatives in higher education. And the biggest challenge we have right now is figuring out which of those initiatives we should double down on and invest and scale up. Has anybody had that conversation recently? The whole notion about which few things should we double down on and really know that's going to drive. You got to get the data to be able to do that. And that's where this whole notion of learner relationship management, from the first time you contact with that student to the time they graduate and analyzing that journey, is really going to matter for us. And that's going to be a discipline, right? And it has got to be anchored in the analytics. And what we'd hope is by the time you're done with this, you actually have some pretty well-defined modal student pathways that say, this is how students navigate our institution, here's where we lose them, and we're very clear about what the challenges are, and here are the big interventions we have that seem to have the biggest kind of impact. Our problem is we tend to have all those conversations siloed along the way, and we haven't done the work to holistically look at that journey for the student from end to end. The challenge here is for us to figure out how we do that kind of end-to-end analysis. But to what end? And I'll close with this as a final conversation. We've got to keep our eye on the prize. Our eye on the prize for this is we are about helping students be ready for a world beyond our four walls, beyond our many walls at our institutions. Seth Godin talked about this in his keynote, but the whole idea of instilling in those students critical learning, creative learning, social learning, and courageous learning. And courageous learning is really the ability to continue to learn, to have the courage to learn new things. Many of you know the famous quote that says, you know, the learners inherit the future. The learned usually are equipped to live in a world that no longer exists. Okay? And the idea for us is figuring out how you really can leverage these systems in a creative way to make sure critical learning, creative learning, social learning, and courageous learning are emphasized. What's fascinating to me is how important social learning really is in this mix. The more we talk about technology, the more social learning really comes in, because now we have deeply complex social environments that we're all still figuring out. I travel 200,000 miles a year, and every single time I go into an airport restroom, some guy comes he's wearing a business suit on a cell phone on what sounds like a very important call into our restroom, right? And I don't know the etiquette. Am I allowed to flush? I don't know. I don't know what the rules are with this, because we're all figuring this stuff out. They're in the stall next to you having a full conversation. You think they're talking to you. You don't know what's going on. And as we have all these devices and ways to connect our families and our teams and our organizations, we're trying to figure out, when is it right to use which technology, which communication strategy, when is it important to turn all that stuff off and have face-to-face conversations with our kids and with our employees and with our bosses, and when is it important for our team to really bond, to really get to the point where you can be nimble. This is complex. It really is about modes and motives of communication and connection, and the social learning is more complex than ever before. Why do most people get their first jobs? Is it because of the degrees they get from your institutions? How do most people actually get their first jobs? Social connections, right? It's not necessarily LinkedIn. It's about usually personal social connections. Why are most people fired from their jobs? Take out economic downturn, layoffs. I'm talking about, why are most people terminated? Is it because of technical incompetence? No. I mean, the data is pretty clear from SHRM and from AMA. Most people are terminated because of interpersonal conflict. And sometimes the organization goes through backflips to find a technical reason to fire the person, but the real reason they're firing them is interpersonal conflict. In fact, SHRM calls it the jerk effect. Either you're fired because you are a jerk, or you're fired by a jerk. But there's always a jerk involved in that situation somewhere, right? They need to learn about this in the infrastructure of our higher education institutions, because that's the world they're going to walk into. They have to be a part. One of the reasons you want dynamic social environments leveraging technology in your universities and community colleges is because that's the world they're walking into, and they're going to die a terrible death professionally, if you will. Think about Anthony Weiner or whoever else you want to think about, because they don't understand how these things can be leveraged, right? Or can't be leveraged, or shouldn't be leveraged, or whatever else, or even whether you should be doing the first thing you're doing in the first place. The challenge for us is helping that student be ready for the world that they're going to walk into. And here's the big bang for the buck on this one. What the students have made pretty clear in focus groups with me is that the best way for them to learn these kinds of skills is to actually watch us use these skills as we take on challenges like transforming our educational environment. Can we be critical thinkers about what's working and what's not working? Can we be creative about the solutions? Can we get along as we're doing this process? And do we have the courage to actually take on these challenges and do some of these big things? Those are big questions, right? And if we want them to actually develop these skills, it's probably important for us to engage them in that larger conversation. There's a couple things I want to close with, but I do want to open it up for questions, either from our online audience, thank you for staying with us, or from folks who are in the room. And this is where the best and brightest respond early and often. So any questions you have would be great. Yeah. The slides will be in the EDUCAUSE resource section. You have full access to it. I think there's only about 18, 19 slides. I'm always careful about that. I had a student focus group once where a student said, most people who use PowerPoint have no power nor a point. Made me very careful about my PowerPoint slides, right? But yeah, they'll all be available. Other questions? Yeah, so the question is, can we build the plane while we're flying, right? And I think for things like simulations and gaming and blended learning, we have to. I think the biggest thing I'm calling for is your help in catalyzing these conversations on your campuses, especially two things. One, keep the innovators going. Really encourage them to think about their innovations and how they can move it to a scale where it can have impact on the larger students. And two, anchor it in analytics so you can have the conversation in a tough-minded way about what's improving learning and what's not. What kills the innovation conversation is it's not anchored in the tough-minded analytics, and so it's tough to be able to keep the conversation going. And we end up with, and I'll close with these two ideas. One, if you're going to take on these conversations, you got to buckle your seatbelts, because these conversations in general are dominated by two big groups on our campuses. One group I like to call the caustic cynics. Caustic cynics are angry about everything. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. You bring manna from heaven, it's too salty for them, right? A friend of mine calls them cave people, colleagues against virtually everything, right? How many of you know a cave person somewhere in your world, right? If you don't know one, you might be. Okay. They're only equaled in the trouble that they cause and the challenges they cause in these conversations, and they are equaled by the true believers. The true believers who oversell, overhype, and underdeliver on the promises. They think online learning is for everybody. Whatever technology they're about, everybody should be using. And the truth is, this is more complex. And for us, the challenge is to hold these conversations in a way where we can temper the true believers, calm down the caustic cynics, and create a space for some tough-minded give and take about what really can work to improve learning. We've got big issues, folks. We have students who need our help, who are desperately trying to leverage education to move on a pathway to possibility, and they're flailing. They desperately need our help. And if we can develop the right kinds of technology resources that really are at our fingertips and get them the information, the resources, and the learning capabilities, they can move to a greater pathway to possibility. It is absolutely worth every bit of our effort, and I hope you're excited about it, folks. Thanks.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.